It's Thursday, November 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Coming up, public hearings begin next week in the Trump impeachment inquiry.
It will be an opportunity for the American people to evaluate the witnesses for themselves, to make their own determinations about the credibility of the witnesses, but also to learn firsthand about the facts of the president's misconduct.
Also ahead, Democrats make gains in key elections. Heavy pollution gags New Delhi. Investigations continue into the Mexican massacre. We'll visit Asia America, and music history is made in Vienna on today's International Edition. The top U.S. diplomat in Ukraine told impeachment investigators Wednesday that it was his clear understanding that Kiev would not get military assistance that President Donald Trump was withholding unless it launched investigations that would help him politically. Bill Taylor, the top American envoy in Ukraine, testified in private last month. In a transcript of his testimony released Wednesday, Taylor said that Gordon Sondland, the U.S. ambassador to the European Union, had repeatedly told him that while Trump did not view the reciprocal deal, or told him that Trump did not view a reciprocal deal as a quid pro quo. According to Taylor's testimony, I observed that in order to move forward on the security assistance, the Ukrainians were told by Ambassador Sondland that they had to pursue the investigations. For weeks, President Trump has said there was no quid pro quo arrangement with Ukraine, $391 million in military aid in exchange for the investigation he wanted of former Vice President Joe Biden, one of Trump's top 2020 Democratic challengers. The release of Taylor's testimony came as a high-ranking State Department official, David Hale, testified Wednesday about the ouster of America's former ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, who some of Trump's aides viewed as an impediment to getting Kiev to open an investigation of Biden and his son, Hunter. A career diplomat, Yovanovitch was abruptly recalled from Kiev earlier this year and dismissed from her posting months ahead of the scheduled end of her tour. Meanwhile, House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff announced Wednesday that public hearings into the impeachment inquiry will begin next week.
We will begin our open hearings in the impeachment inquiry next week. We will be beginning with the testimony of Ambassador Taylor and Ambassador Kent on Wednesday, and we will have Ambassador Yovanovitch testify on Friday. These will be the first of the open hearings.
Schiff said that the intelligence, judiciary, and government oversight committees have been getting a clearer picture of the way President Trump allegedly abused his power in order to get Ukraine to open investigations that would benefit him politically.
We are getting an increasing appreciation for just what took place during the course of the last year and the degree to which the president enlisted whole departments of government in the illicit aim of trying to get Ukraine to dig up dirt on a political opponent, as well as further conspiracy theory about the 2016 election that he believed would be beneficial to his reelection campaign.
Republican Congressman Jim Jordan of Ohio, the ranking Republican on the Oversight Committee, said Wednesday the hearings have validated the president's argument that there was no quid pro quo between Trump and Ukraine's Volodymyr Zelensky.
Actually, as we hear more testimony, in fact, the testimony that we're hearing today, it's actually getting easier to defend the president from a standpoint there is no linkage between aid. In fact, what we're hearing today is this is part of a broader analysis of foreign aid in general in terms of what we should do. It wasn't just Ukraine where the aid was held up.
The impeachment probe started after a U.S. intelligence community official lodged a complaint because he was troubled by Trump's request to Zelensky to investigate Biden, his son Hunter Biden's work for a Ukrainian gas company, and any possible Ukrainian involvement in the 2016 election. On Wednesday, the president's son Donald Trump Jr., meanwhile, tweeted an article that alleged to identify the so-called whistleblower. Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman and Trump ally Lindsey Graham of South Carolina said whistleblower laws are not meant to keep someone anonymous.
It's designed to protect you from being fired if you come forward. It doesn't give you anonymity. Nobody should be prosecuted based on an anonymous accusation. Impeachment is the political death penalty. without the whistleblower complaint, none of this would be going on. So I want to know who the person is. But the people who should do this are the Intel Committee in the Senate. They're the ones that were assigned this case. I think it's impossible to go forward without knowing who the whistleblower is and giving the president a chance to cross-examine his accuser.
Illinois Democratic Senator Dick Durbin, meanwhile, said that President Trump and his supporters are just looking for revenge against the whistleblower.
This notion that this person should be brought before the American people now, publicly disclosed and punished, and that's what's really behind it all, is just the exact opposite of what we expect in a democracy.
President Trump has denied any wrongdoing, describing his call with Zelensky as perfect, and repeatedly said there was no quid pro quo with Ukraine. But a handful of U.S. officials have told investigators that Trump was pushing for such a reciprocal deal, even though after a weeks-long delay, he eventually released the money to Kiev. Among the top stories on our VOAnews.com website, mixed results for Trump in Tuesday's elections. Erdogan threatens deepening Russian ties unless U.S. unfreezes jet sale. France tries 23 in alleged Nigerian sex slave ring. Doctors warn of pollution's impact on health in New Delhi. And U.S. skips ASEAN talks as Asian leaders seek new trade deal. Expanded coverage of these stories and more is on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Democrats have scored historic wins in Virginia, and the Kentucky governor's race is still a matter of debate in some off-year elections that come just 1 year before the next presidential vote. What does that mean for President Donald Trump and for the Democratic candidate who will eventually challenge him? Well, to give us a little bit of perspective, Jim Malone joins us in the studio. Jim is our national correspondent. Jim, thanks for being here.
Sure thing.
These are what's referred to as the off-year elections. They're not midterms and they're not presidentials, but they were very important in being a kind of barometer for next year. We're within 1 year of the next presidential election as we speak. And so what's your take on what happened Tuesday?
Yeah, I mean, political analysts like to fancy themselves as tea leaf readers as well. And we're always looking for some of the trends that jump out at us from these various state results. Obviously, the Democrats have a lot to be happy about. The results in Virginia, the state and local level, showed them taking over now both chambers of the state legislature. They also have the governorship from previously. So Virginia continues to swing solidly to the Democratic column. And in the state of Kentucky, now that's a solid, what we call red state, Republican state. The president won there, I believe, by 30 points back in 2016. But a Democrat has emerged as the leader there. He's claiming victory, Andy Beshear. Of course, there's no official result yet. The Associated Press still calling in the race, too close to call. But he defeated Matt Bevin, a Republican governor, who may be perhaps the most unpopular governor in the country, but who closely tied himself to President Trump and was hoping the president could pull him across the finish line, but came up a little short, it appears.
And in the state of Mississippi in the Deep South, there was a Republican who won the governorship there as well. But that's not really a surprise because Mississippi is a deeply Republican state. But the margin there was a lot smaller than people thought, right?
Certainly in single digits, the Democrat gave a good showing in Mississippi. And I think the other trend we're really looking at here in some of these recent elections, and not only this year, but in the midterm elections of a year ago when Democrats retook control of the House of Representatives, what are suburban voters doing? What do they think of President Trump and how are they reacting? And it's skewing toward the Democrats at this point, and that could have significant consequences for President Trump and the Republicans in 2020. We know Republicans do very well with rural voters around the country. That was the case in Kentucky on Tuesday as well. And Democrats do well in the cities and the close-in sort of urban areas. But the suburbs are really a battleground for both parties. And Whichever party tends to prevail in the suburbs, especially in presidential years, tends to win the White House. So this is right now trending the Democrats' way. It's something they're going to want to double down on as they look ahead to next year.
There's an old adage that says that all politics is local, but in this case, the politics of the locality, the Kentucky governor's race, the Mississippi governor's race, the national picture, President Trump and his impeachment inquiry on Capitol Hill under the Democrats in the House, that played a big role in these races as well, did it not?
It did. Now, you take the Democrat who apparently has won in Kentucky, and he's saying he won on local issues. He didn't think the White House was a factor. But certainly Matt Bevin, the Republican candidate, had Trump in a few days before the election. He welcomed him warmly at a rally. The same for the governor-elect in Mississippi. They see Trump as an important player for Republicans nationally, so they want him to campaign with them. But we saw the limits of it, perhaps, for the president's influence in Kentucky. He was just not able to overcome Bevin's unpopularity in the state. So it does seem to indicate there are some limits to the president's magic, at least with Republican voters. And that's something that Republicans in Congress will be watching as they move through the impeachment battle. How much are voters still tied to President Trump? Right now, as far as we can tell, Republicans still are very much, you know, loyal to the president. We think that's the way it would play out in the impeachment battle, both in the impeachment process in the House, and if he is impeached in the House, then an impeachment trial in the Senate.
And we have one-third of the Senate and the entire House, in addition to the president, up for re-election in less than a year. The primaries start in February. Jim Malone is our national correspondent. Jim, thank you very much.
You bet.
You can follow more of Jim's coverage of the elections and the Trump impeachment on our website, voanews.com. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm David Byrd in Washington. In the Indian capital, New Delhi, authorities declared a public health emergency this month as air pollution levels hit hazardous levels, a problem that the city wrestles with in winter when stagnant winds and cooler temperatures hold toxic air over the city. Doctors warn that the filthy air is extracting a serious toll on the health of the city's 20 million residents. From New Delhi, Anjana Pasricha has this report.
Days before Delhi's landmarks and buildings virtually disappeared behind a grey haze of pollution, Nandini Guha left the city for a few weeks. Just months ago, medical tests showed that the longtime city resident had developed asthma.
I have already been put on inhalers and on nasal sprays, so I don't want to fall so sick that I have to be hospitalized.
Guha was heeding doctors who advise those who can to leave Delhi in winter when the city gets trapped in toxic smog.
Breathlessness, acute attacks of asthma, acute pneumonia, especially in young children and elderly. These are three immediate impacts that we see.
The long-term consequences are even more deadly.
To my mind, there is no true non-smoker in polluted cities, because whether you inhale pollution smoke or you inhale cigarette smoke, the effect on your system is the same. Both lead to higher incidence of lung diseases, including lung cancer.
In a bid to reduce the smog, nearly half the city's cars have been taken off the roads for 12 days by allowing those with number plates ending with odd and even numbers out on alternate days. Environmental experts say to clean up its air, Delhi needs permanent action to reduce the massive fleet of nearly 9 million vehicles clogging its roads by scaling up public transport.
The transportation sector will require the most disruptive action, because as you know that the dependence on personal vehicles has increased to such an extent, and the data in Delhi showing that since 2010, the emissions from transport sector alone has increased by 40%.
That action will not happen soon. So doctors are focusing on sensitizing people about the most dangerous pollutant in Delhi's air, tiny particulate matter known as PM2.5.
There's no point in talking to people about the numbers, you know. If you tell them PM is 400, PM is 450, I mean, it doesn't really connect with them. But if you tell them that a 28-year-old non-smoker girl in Delhi has got lung cancer, and that's probably because of the effect of air pollution, suddenly people sit up and take notice of that. So we wanted to use health messaging as a means of conveying the sense of urgency to people.
That is why for many children, like this 4-year-old, indoor swings have replaced those in parks.
The maximum what we do is take her to play in some mall in the play area. But we don't expose her to the weather outside.
Some still brave the dense smog to enjoy a holiday. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
As Iraqi protesters burn effigies of Iran's supreme leader and set fire to Iran's consulate in Karbala, 40 years of Iranian policy toward its neighbors appears to be going up in smoke. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
Protesters in Baghdad chanted slogans against Iran's Shiite proxy militias in Iraq as the demonstrators set fire to pictures of Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and his top regional commander, General Qasem Soleimani. Crowds of mostly young Iraqi protesters set fire Sunday to parts of the Iranian consulate in the Shiite holy city of Karbala as young men danced on the walls outside the building. Khamenei provoked the anger of many Iraqis last week when he accused foreign countries of fomenting anti-government protests in both Iraq and Lebanon. He says the United States and some Western and Gulf states have been supporting the riots and chaos in Iraq and Lebanon. Iraq's top Shiite leader, Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, through his Friday prayer leader, Sayyid Ali Safi, told Iraqis that no outside force should be able to impose its will on them in reference to Iran. Former Iranian President Abul Hassan Bani Sadr tells VOA the ongoing popular protests in both Iraq and Lebanon have made a shambles of nearly 40 years of policy by the Iranian regime to create a crescent that unites Iran to Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. Ayatollah Khamenei, he says, cannot explain to his own people how 40 years of efforts backed by blood and treasure have gone down the drain so quickly with these popular movements. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Security has stepped up in the restive Mexican region where the massacre of 9 American women and children has rocked both Mexico and the United States. Monday's dirt road ambush of 3 families of Mormon origin was the deadliest attack on U.S. citizens in Mexico in recent memory, and it put the close-knit religious communities in the uncomfortable spotlight of the country's raging drug war. The 6 children and 3 women killed were all members of the extended LeBaron family living in a remote farming community of La Mora. In La Mora's sister community of Colonia LeBaron on Wednesday, residents were still in shock. Elsie Lydiard is a relative of some of the victims.
We're very saddened that something like this can even happen to 3 mothers and to all these children that were just traveling. I feel angry. I'm pretty sure that most of this community feels angry and upset with the way the security system is working here in Mexico.
In 2009, a member of the LeBaron family, 32-year-old Benjamin LeBaron, was killed by cartel gunmen in retaliation for his anti-crime activism. His younger brother was kidnapped but was later released. William Stubbs is a 49-year-old pecan and alfalfa farmer who for the past 10 years has served on the Security Committee at LeBaron. He says he doesn't believe that Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador's programs will reduce the violence.
I don't know how they're going to react to everything that's going on, but our government seems that they don't want violence with violence. But it seems like since our new government went in, it seems like these people have gotten more power. And we see it all over. And how it's going to happen, how our government's going to happen, we don't know.
President López Obrador told reporters Wednesday that the Mexican government would take charge of the investigation, but the United States could work alongside Mexican officials.
Nosotros nos encargamos.
He said, we will take charge of the investigation and for justice to be done. We don't have any limitations on us for informing the media on how it's going. If the United States want to participate, then they can. President Donald Trump said earlier this week that the United States and Mexico need to wage war against the cartels, a policy that López Obrador has rejected. William Stubbs said the members of his community welcome U.S. intervention and don't believe that Obrador's plan will work.
It's definitely appreciated. They definitely need help. The way that the government is going right now with their way of doing things, I feel like it's going to be very difficult for his plans to be successful.
Officials say the gunman might have mistaken the group's large SUVs for those of a rival gang amid a vicious turf war. The Juarez drug cartel and its armed wing, known as La Linea, or The Line, are fighting against a faction of the Sinaloa cartel, known as the Salazar. For more on this story, you can visit our website, voanews.com. Coming up, we'll visit the capital of Asia America, and music history is made in Vienna. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. The capital of Asia America is just one description used for an area spanning 36 kilometers just east of downtown Los Angeles, the San Gabriel Valley. Nearly 500,000 Asians live in this region. It's an Asian enclave where 9 cities in the area are majority Asian. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has more on why so many Asians live there and the countries they represent.
The San Gabriel Valley, known to locals as the SGV, has been home to Mike Chow for 30 years. When he was 5 years old, his parents immigrated from Taiwan and chose the city of Walnut to settle down. It's a city that is majority Asian.
My parents, they didn't speak English at the time, so it's made it easier for them to kind of get around. It's so close to all the shopping. There's a good sense of that Asian community. It made fitting in a lot easier.
There is a largely immigrant and ethnic Chinese population in the SGV that started with a flood of people from Taiwan in the 1970s, then continued to trickle in the 80s when Chow arrived. Now he's a real estate agent and leads a multilingual team, including Roxanne Shone, who sells houses in the region.
Most of my clients are Mandarin-speaking, Chinese, But they're either living here and work here or study here, or they come to the United States just to invest, to buy investment property.
In the last 10 to 15 years, people from mainland China have become the new immigrants to the SGV. Originally from China, Sheng arrived in the U.S. for graduate school and stayed. She says there are many reasons why the SGV is attractive to the Chinese.
Everyone speaks Mandarin. They can walk into bank, post office, grocery stores. They can do everything without speaking English.
Immigrants are also attracted to Southern California's mild climate and relatively close distance to Asia when compared to other U.S. cities. For immigrants who are used to living in high-rise apartments in China,
we have plenty of single-family homes. They just buy the house, they get the land, they get the yard, and they have no neighbors up or down below them.
Immigrants from other Southeast Asian countries also live in the region.
So I speak Tagalog, the Hokkien, and Mandarin, and English.
Annie Xu came to the U.S. from the Philippines with her husband. Also a part of Mike Chow's real estate team, she has found homes for immigrants from Southeast Asia, such as the Philippines, Indonesia, and South Asia.
Newly built homes.
Shabana Khan is one of her clients who is looking for a house with a yard. She is Indian and Pakistani and moved to the SGV from New York.
New York has the vibe of the energy and stuff, but you can get it here too, you know. But as soon as you have kids, I think California is the best place to settle down. San Gabriel Valley is amazing. You have so many different cultures within Asia.
The diversity of Asian cultures here also means a variety of socioeconomic realities. A report by Asian Americans Advancing Justice Los Angeles estimates the undocumented Asian population to be 58,000 in the SGV, and close to a third of Asian Americans are low income.
Some of them just immigrated here. They haven't found a stable job, or their English is not good enough that they have to compromise for a job that's not ideal for them.
No matter what the socioeconomic status is, the Asian population in the San Gabriel Valley continues to grow because it is an area that makes the transition from an Asian culture to an American one much easier. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News.
Vienna, Austria is no stranger to musical milestones, but a musical first occurred Wednesday when the ORF Radio Symphony Orchestra marked its 50th anniversary by having its first female conductor. American maestro Marin Alsop took the baton to lead the ensemble in a program that included Friedrich Serha's three movements for orchestra and Robert Schumann's Symphony No. 2 in C major. Alsop, who previously led orchestras in Bournemouth, England, Baltimore, Maryland, and Sao Paulo, Brazil, said her reception in Vienna was very warm.
I haven't felt this kind of welcome in a long time. It's been very, very warm, very receptive. People are excited. It feels like people are ready for a change. And they say, come on, let's go. So I'm very happy about it.
Globally, only 4% of conductors are women, and the situation is no different in Vienna. The city's world-famous Vienna Philharmonic, whose New Year concert is a broadcast to more than 90 countries across the globe, started admitting women only in 1997, and men still vastly outnumber women on the podium of that orchestra's home, the legendary Musikverein in Concert Hall. Alsop also says that she sees her taking the baton at the ORF Radio Symphony as a step in the right direction.
When I started in this career as a conductor, it was very lonely being a woman. But today I'm very excited because there are a lot more opportunities for young women in the field. So I feel that I have company now, and we just have to sustain the momentum and be vigilant about equal rights, not just for women, but underrepresented people in positions of authority.
More than half of Vienna's music students are female, but they are still a relatively rare sight in conducting classes. In the rarefied world of conducting, sexist stereotypes that women lack the necessary strength and authority to lead an orchestra are deep-seated. Wednesday's first concert was the first of a two-season project to perform and record all four of Schumann's symphonies with the instrumentation of Gustav Mahler. You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. And thanks for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Enjoy the day.
This is VOA News.